AI is coming like a freight train into medicine and clinical medicine, and it'll be very useful at the end of the day in helping, particularly around the diagnosis and early diagnosis of a whole range of conditions. Accessibility is something that does motivate us. How can we make some of this technology really efficient, really accessible, and therefore inexpensive, and can be used in a variety of different settings?
Welcome to the Dementia Research Project. I'm Matt DeRay, and in this podcast, I explore the history, innovation, and champions in and around the world of dementia. Professor James Vickers is the director of the Wicking Dementia Research and Education Center. Professor Vickers has dedicated his life to researching neurodegenerative diseases, traumatic brain injury, and health services for dementia. The Wicking Center is part of the University of Tasmania and is at the forefront of translational research and support for issues confronting people with dementia and their carers. Welcome, Professor. How are you?
Thank you, Matthew. Thank you very much for having me.
To kick things off, Professor, what sparked your journey into academia and dementia in particular?
Thank you. And not to tell too long a story, but I started off my university studies with a bit of an interest in the brain and psychology. And that led me to undertake a research degree, specifically in the neurosciences, and looking at neurons and what was inside them and so forth. And then led me on to a particular interest around Alzheimer's disease and brain aging. And it was a fascinating time to be involved in that kind of research, because this was back in the 90s and their understanding of Alzheimer's disease was really blossoming. And then as I went further along in my career, I got more interested in how we might apply research so it's more practically useful to people who maybe have a caring role, in this case for people with dementia. Working with lots of really fine colleagues in our center, we developed a number of educational programs, and we also expanded our research into other areas, again, that involved more human beings rather than experimental models. Again, trying to do a few projects that might bring a practical outcome to people.
Could you share a bit about Wicking and what is its underlying mission and goal?
Yes, thank you. So the Wicking Centre has been around for about 16 years or so. And it got started because I had a really excellent colleague called Andrew Robinson, who was the Professor of Aged Care Nursing. And he was a social sciences researcher. And then there was me, who was more of a research on brains. And we thought it'd be interesting if the two of us got together and combined our expertise and various approaches to see if we, again, can't do something useful in the area of dementia. And we set that up in the University of Tasmania. It was very small. And we bumbled along, I think, for a few years, trying to really work out what our strategy and focus should be. But Andrew's own research had shown that really quite widely, it didn't matter if you were the person who might develop dementia or a family carer or an aged care worker or even a health professional like a doctor or a nurse, there was a good chance that your knowledge about dementia wasn't likely to be that great. We thought we would start in the area of developing educational programs. And then we also ended up focusing our research really around three areas: the cause, prevention, and care of dementia. And so I guess fast forward to now, here in 2024, the center's grown quite a lot. And a lot of that growth has been through education, both our free courses, as well as we offer formal university courses at the undergraduate and postgraduate level. So there's quite a substantial number of academic staff who are doing both teaching and research.
Right. When you started out in the early days, did you start out with that MOOC content? Because I'm just looking at some of the statistics here. Your MOOC program has had 500,000 participants from 184 countries, which is really impressive.
Yeah. So our initial idea was that we needed to develop something that got to as many people as possible. And then when we were thinking about this, it was when they had the rise of the MOOCs. So these are massive open online courses. And the idea of these is to present something online for free and to get to as many people as possible. So we adopted that approach. And our first book was really designed to provide a holistic view on dementia, from what causes dementia through clinical management, if you like, but then very importantly, how you might configure the best possible care for somebody with dementia. It couldn't cover every topic, but it tried to cover as much as it could in a sort of holistic way, which was really oriented around this idea that these are degenerative and progressive conditions, and so people get worse over time, and we need to think about kind of care that we might provide at different stages of dementia. So that was the overlying theme or rubric of that course. And it took off much more extensively than we planned. And so we did open up to anybody in the world could do it. And so most people who have done that course have been in Australia. But we've got to pretty much nearly every other recognized country out there. And of course, originally we did very well in English-speaking countries and Commonwealth countries. But more recently, it's been really good. We've seen a real growth in people doing those dementia MOOCs in Southeast Asia and then through to Africa as well too. And we do a little bit of marketing, mostly on social media, but the growth has really been, I think, mostly around word of mouth. So people have found it useful and then they share it in their networks and then more people do it. So it's snowballed over the years. And yeah, so we have two MOOCs on dementia. One is this overall picture, which is called the Understanding Dementia MOOC. And then we have another MOOC that's specifically about building awareness about risk factors for dementia. And that's called the Prevent Dementia MOOC.
Gotcha. You mentioned the three segments to this: prevention, treatment, and care.
Yeah.
Where do you see the student interest most in, especially for some of your bachelors?
Most things we do, we try and combine a perspective in all of those areas in our courses. What really surprised us about the MOOC was that we actually start that MOOC with brief coverage of the brain and then how it's affected by particular dementia-related diseases like Alzheimer's disease or frontotemporal dementia. And then we go on to clinical management and then we go on to care. And I was very nervous about that approach because I thought a lot of people would be switched off by having to learn a lot of neuroscience right away. But people seem to like it. And we have surveys at the end of the MOOC to try and get an idea of what participants liked and didn't like. And it seems that they did like this sort of start with the brain and how the diseases affect the brain. Because a little bit with that one is that if people understand that it's a disease and not just a consequence of aging, then understanding that person's abilities and disabilities at various stages, it becomes a little bit easier. So you've got a prism for seeing why people progress with Alzheimer's disease. And the other side of that is that people sometimes they might blame the person with dementia for certain behaviors, or if they get annoyed if they're repeating themselves, or for example, they get up in the middle of the night and want to go out or do something. And I think they come to understand it's not about that person with dementia trying to make your life difficult. It's because the brain is affected in a specific way. And because of that, then the behaviors and how they respond to various things will change as well too. So that actually turned out to be a useful way of packaging that information. Now, of course, if somebody comes on and does our undergraduate degree or our relatively new master's degree, they'll go into those topics in much greater detail.
Right. What is the typical profile of somebody that comes in for a MOOC? From what I understand, I suppose a lot of caregivers, it's a resource for them, but what other things are you seeing?
Yeah, so it's what we call informal caregivers or family carers is a big segment. The next sort of group is people who work usually in support roles. So aged care workers of various kinds. And the third group tends to be health professionals, particularly allied health practitioners and nurses, and the occasional doctors. But sitting underneath that's really quite interesting is that by far and away the majority of people who do the MOOCs are women, and they're women in their 40s and 50s. So they've probably had a fair bit of lived experience of dementia either through their family or professionally. And they're often there also juggling work and family responsibilities and caring responsibilities while they're doing the course as well too. So they bring a lot of their own experience to those courses. And in those MOOCs, we have an opportunity for people to join in on discussion topics and share their experience. And that was, I think, part of the reason why the MOOCs have worked quite well is that sort of social learning aspect. And so it's been really terrific that people come on and they really do add to the education by telling their stories about their experiences with dementia from different perspectives as well too. We've tried over the years to get other segments to do the MOOC. In particular, men seem to be quite reluctant to undertake such courses as well too, for reasons we don't really quite understand. But we do spend a lot of time thinking about how we can get to various groups of people we think might benefit from doing those MOOCs.
That's very interesting. For your postgraduate courses, what are some of the typical career pathways after they complete their studies?
Yeah. So the postgraduate course, which you can do it at different levels, that is largely attuned to people who, of course, have already got a degree and whose work touches on aged care and dementia. So the sort of the profile of people doing the postgraduate degree tends to be healthcare professionals, particularly nurses and, again, allied health practitioners. But we find still quite a variety of different people with different backgrounds. And there's certainly people who do the masters because they might be in a policy position in their work that touches on aged care and dementia. So they need to understand dementia a little bit better so that they can do their work in policy. And also the other group is those people who are in management roles as well, might be managers of aged care facilities or have some sort of senior role within those facilities. And again, they're looking to add to their expertise. Yes, masters is very much geared towards people who've already got a degree and usually they've had quite a bit of experience in the field. Whereas our undergraduate degree, again, you can do that at different levels. And the most popular one is a one-year course we call the Diploma of Dementia Care. And that's really been quite popular with people who are, for example, aged care workers, mostly in Australia, but people who are employed to work in community care or in residential care or respite care or one of those areas. And quite frequently, they come on and do that course after they've done the MOOC. The MOOC gives them a bit of an introduction to university level learning and teaching. And if they do that and enjoy that and think that's worthwhile, they might supplement that with this diploma qualification. And our overall approach there is what we try and do is have an ecosystem of different educational offerings so that people, depending on their background and their needs, they might only ever want to do a little bit of education, like a MOOC, or they might want to dedicate a few years to completing their masters. Yeah. And it really will depend on what people need to get out of that educational offering. And what's been really nice again is that we see quite often people who do the MOOC and following that, their interests are increased and then they come on to a university degree.
That's fantastic. In the marketing world, we call that a bit of a funnel, right?
A funnel, yes. That's right. Yeah.
People find out about it through the most accessible means and then they get that bug and then they go down that rabbit hole. Really, yeah.
And we hope that in that way, I think you're absolutely right. And not necessarily what we designed it that way, but I think with the MOOCs in particular, what we tried to do there is to give basically relatively high level research information, teaching that you would find in many university courses, but to make it accessible and easy for people to progress through. And I think it does work quite well that way. And that helps build people's confidence. So they might think, yes, this is a pathway that I want to keep following. I'll come on and do the next thing. But the interesting thing with our university courses, we have very few full-time students. It's also, they're all online. So people do it in their own time. Pretty much nearly everybody who does those courses is doing it on a part-time basis. Because again, they're adults who are juggling often jobs, family and other responsibilities, and they don't have the time to do it on a full-time basis. So it can, even with a diploma of dementia care, it can take a 2 or 3 years for somebody to actually finish what's actually a one-year course normally.
How do you think about integrating learnings from your research projects into your programs? Because I understand that's a big part of what you guys think about.
Yes, no, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, we do. As much as makes sense, we try and filter through what's happening in our own research through to the MOOCs. And it does appear quite often in our undergraduate and postgraduate degrees as examples. But we're also really careful. It's not just about our research. We need to make sure that we're covering the most contemporary research outcomes that exist. And that's often a bit of a challenge, because that means basically you've got to keep updating all of your educational materials quite frequently. And our first MOOC now is just over 10 years of age, and we've decided we're going to do a big review of that MOOC and bring it up to speed, make sure it's based on the latest research and as contemporary as possible without wrecking the course in the meantime as well too. Yeah, that also, I guess, relates to the excellent staff that we've got. So our academic staff, they're involved in research as much as in teaching. And we think that's really important, because not only can they talk about their own research, if that's relevant, but also that means they're very good at sifting research from other centres and across the globe, so that we know that it's reliable and high quality research and not just regurgitating press releases or something. So it's a little bit, moves beyond a little bit like what you might find in a textbook, for example, because we try and be as up to date as possible.
Speaking of research, when I was reading your annual report, I came across this island project. Could you share a bit about this?
Sure, yes. So this is the ISLAND, stands for Island Study Linking Aging and Neurodegenerative Disease. And yes, quite coincidentally, Tasmania is also an island. So that was, we had those things well linked, because what we thought we would do is to prototype an approach to dementia risk reduction in our little island state of Tasmania. So we were seeking to recruit as many people as we could over the age of 50 and get them involved in activities that related to dementia risk. We now know there are at least 14 factors that research tells us are associated with risk and that are potentially modifiable. There are absolutely other factors associated with risk that are much less modifiable, the chief one being aging. The older you are, the higher risk you have of developing dementia. But outside of that and genetics, then there are all these other things that, in theory, if we could do something about. And some of those things we could ask people to look at and challenge in their own life are these health factors or health behaviors, things that they might want to address and change. And of course, other ones are things a little bit more systemic and may not be beyond the control of the individual, and might relate to what we have in place in terms of policies and laws and rules and things. But what we do with the island project is we invite people to do a survey, and we call the dementia risk profile, which then gives them feedback on these areas that they might be at no particular risk, or they might be at a bit higher risk. And it's really like a traffic light system. So green is good, orange is probably not so great, and then red is not good at all. And then based on that sort of feedback, we look to see whether people might change over time once they have been able to highlight for themselves where they need to take some action. With that too, we offer educational resources. We try and go around our state as well too with again, messages around dementia risk. And we've been going for about 5 years with that project. And at the 3-year mark, we did an evaluation. And what we found overall is that about, in terms of the main set of risk factors, there was about a 25% reduction across the whole sample. Now, I should be careful there, because actually at the end of the day, a lot of people who volunteer for these kinds of research are often quite healthy anyway. And so it's a sample where quite a lot of people had not many risk factors, and much smaller proportion had lots of risk factors. But still overall, the 25% reduction is likely to be fairly meaningful. So we're continuing to work on that, and we're looking at opportunities where we might be able to extend that nationally and potentially internationally as well too. But that's all down to funding. And so we're applying to all sorts of places to try and get some funding to help support. But that's what we think, if not the island project, something like it as a public health, whole of population approach to try and reduce those risk factors. And again, I have to be careful, because you may have not many risk factors, but you still might get dementia. So it's just something that might modify your risk, not necessarily protect you forever from ever getting. Conversely, a lot of people have lots of those risk factors, and then they don't get dementia as well too. But again, with looking at it as a whole population, that hopefully shifting this by 10, 20 or 30% will mean in your population, there'll be less people who will develop dementia in their lifetime. So you'll hopefully reduce the incidence and then have some impact on the prevalence or the numbers of people with dementia.
For a huge project like this, Professor, essentially you're reaching out to a huge swath of the population. How do you think about collaborations, partnership to make it happen?
Yeah,
Those
things are really important. And I guess let's take one of those risk factors, like smoking. Smoking is a risk factor for dementia, as it is for a whole bunch of other terrible conditions as well too. So we obviously do our best to send out messages that relate to smoking. But in Tasmania, like there is in many other countries, you know, there are organizations whose job it is to help people to stop smoking. And so it was important for us to reach out to those organizations and basically work in partnership so that we're emphasizing their messages and where they have programs to help people quit smoking, we're trying to funnel people in that direction. So hopefully by being part of Ireland, they'll reflect on that risk factor and think, oh, there were lots of reasons why I should stop smoking and here's another one. Maybe this will be enough for me to be able to commit to a cessation program of some kind. And then not only might you have the benefit in terms of dementia, but you might have a benefit in terms of a whole bunch of other unpleasant chronic and degenerative conditions and cancer. So I think that's the interesting thing about a lot of these risk factors for dementia, that they're either really important in their own right as health factors, or they're risk factors for a number of other conditions as well. Doing something useful for any of those is like they have health benefits beyond potentially just in terms of risk of dementia. But yes, you've got to work in partnership with those organizations who've got the capability and the skills to be able to tackle them properly rather than reinvent the wheel.
Well, one thing I've always been really curious about, especially in with regards to academia and these type of huge studies, once the findings come in, what is that next step to implement these recommendations into industry, into policy? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's actually the hardest piece, which is sometimes we call that translation or implementation. A little bit of an issue with the research world, because there's a lot of funding around to potentially do the research. There's much less funding or clear pathways to do the translation or the implementation of those outcomes. Now, sometimes those outcomes have a clear policy significance, and then you can work with local governments or national governments or other organizations to try and raise the profile of that finding and to get a change. But otherwise, yes, moving from the interesting research outcome to something that's useful for human beings is really tricky. But that's also why we think the education piece is important as well too. So we would hope that through our MOOCs and degrees is that people will understand why that research is important for your role potentially as a carer or a professional of some kind in the aged care sector as well too, and that you can then through the whatever it is, the tens of thousands of people who do those courses, then we could have an impact on those areas by at the end of the day the participants in those courses are like our partners. They're there to help really to implement and translate some of those findings into their daily work or into their role as a carer. So we think the effect can be quite powerful. But generally, yes, it's really quite difficult to go from discovering something interesting and groovy in research and then making it actually something that makes a practical difference.
Maybe this is a good point to talk about the Dream Project, right? Because I think those worlds of education and industry is a lot closer, tight-knit in that particular type of project.
Yeah, so the Dream Project, and DREAM stands for Dementia, Respite, Education and Mentoring. It's a new project for us, which is much more focused on a particular kind of dementia care. And that's the kind of dementia care and support you need to provide in respite. So this is where people might come into a residential facility or a day center or some other kind of facility or institution, or sometimes even have respite in their own home. This is really a growing area. And the goal for respite care is to try and maximize the chances and opportunities of people with dementia to live at home as happily as possible for as long as possible. So it's that they don't have to go into an aged care home, for example. And that's a growing area. And there are some things about providing respite care which become quite important, because what you want that to be is a very positive experience, because you can imagine for some people with dementia, it could be quite challenging to go into a new environment and with new people. And with all that stimulation and everything else, it could turn into an unpleasant experience. And so we want to also make sure that if you have respite, that at the end of that respite, there's a chance for the person with dementia as well as their carers to recharge themselves and be able to approach that, whatever that next phase of caring, with a really positive attitude. So the Australian Commonwealth Government have funded us to develop and deliver this program, which combines education also with what we call a community of practice model, as well as mentoring. So the education piece, we can use some of the things we've already developed, but we have to develop some educational material specifically about dementia respite. And again, it's all online and available for free. The community of practice is what we're trying to achieve there, is get to people who work in respite to come into, basically, it's like a set of discussion topics so that they can, again, people can share their experience or challenges. And then other people, our staff and other people in the working sector, might be able to share some solutions and ideas to meet whatever challenges that arise. And so we're trying to develop basically a bit of a community around those respite workers. And then the final part is around mentoring. And we're partnering with a group called Dementia Support Australia, who have these coaches who will either be on the phone or on video conference or come out and visit directly various facilities that are providing respite care, so that they can be on the ground and helping people to improve, adapt, modify their programs, again, to make that respite experience as positive as possible. And we've only just started with that, but it's going well. There's been quite a lot of people signed up for it across Australia. But it's really about supporting, because what's a growing segment of aged care, at least in Australia, which is around providing risk.
And that's extremely beneficial for the university as well, right? Because I suppose the learnings and information you're receiving in these care centers, they flow back to everything you talked about before, your programming.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And these are really wonderful opportunities to do further research. So we will be encouraging and recruiting people who interact with our program to be involved in research, so that we can systematically evaluate not only the success of the Dream Project, but also to get an idea from participants what does make a successful respite experience. Mm. And probably also importantly, what contributes to a less successful respite experience, so that we can look at how we might modify what we do to improve on that as well too. So it's great that we've got funded for this particular project, but yes, it'll also be a great opportunity to do some more research.
There's a lot of excitement in the dementia community around blood-based biomarkers. There's a lot of institutions doing a lot of great work, and Wiking is one of them. Is there anything you can speak about in terms of your optimism levels?
Yeah, so this dementia is a terrible condition, but it's an exciting area of research. And just, I think, really quite recently, where I don't think we'd made as much progress as people would have liked, but all of a sudden we had to have new drugs, and we've also got new approaches to diagnosis. And many people listening to your podcast would know how difficult it is sometimes to get a diagnosis of dementia. Many doctors may not have much training specifically in that area, and accessing specialist doctors like geriatrician may be quite difficult. Also, still there is a bit of a qualitative aspect to dementia diagnosis, in that many clinicians, it's a diagnosis of a ruling out anything else that might be causing cognitive changes, and then you might be left with the possibility that it might be dementia. So the the sensitivity sometimes of that diagnosis and specificity of that diagnosis can be a little bit tricky. So there's a lot of interest in what we call objective markers that might help with diagnosis. And a number of years ago, there was a lot of excitement around new brain imaging markers. And that's a field that's grown rapidly, but it's also a bit tricky because it's very expensive. And in terms of access, it's not available particularly widely either. And it involves very specialist medical practitioners as well too. Then along came the idea that we could measure things in cerebral spinal fluid, the levels of proteins that have been implicated in neurodegeneration in particular. Again, another really exciting area, but has access problems because, again, you need to have doctors who are comfortable in being able to extract that cerebral spinal fluid, usually through a spinal tap. So this now leads us to where there's a lot of excitement, is that some of those same proteins that we could see in cerebral spinal fluid, we can now measure in blood. And the technology has advanced quite dramatically in recent years, so you can measure very small amounts of these proteins in blood samples. And in particular, you can measure the abnormal proteins that, say, contribute to the pathology that you might see in Alzheimer's disease. It's like that it develops inside the brain and it leaks out of the brain and finds its way into the blood. And then you can measure that in a blood sample. And that is such a rapidly moving area. And there are new, what we call markers or biomarkers, that are being developed all the time. And they're just getting better and better. And we're in the middle of research, and we're involved in this a little bit as well too, is now evaluating how well these might work in a clinic setting. So in the same way that for many other conditions, when you go and see a doctor, they'll go off and send you out for your blood to be looked at for a whole bunch of different things that might relate to, let's say, lung disease or heart disease or cancer. There's an idea you can go send this blood sample in and you'll get a report that says you are high in some of these proteins or there's a change in some of these proteins that are linked with neurodegeneration. So I think that is likely to turn out to be a reliable finding and a useful finding. But still, there'll be problems with that implementation with that one, because at the moment, there's a couple of things. Obviously, you need doctors who are trained to understand what those results mean. So that's an educational component. You do need specialist equipment and people who know how to do that work in order to get that result. Now, that'll improve in the same way that other pathology tests have improved a lot in recent years. But at the moment, it's quite a specialist technique and, again, won't be available very widely. But already in America, there are actually commercial companies now that are setting up to be able to analyze those kinds of results. And while it's a lot cheaper than brain imaging and the tests that involve cerebral spinal fluid, overall, it's still probably going to be quite expensive for a few years until it gets more and more refined and more efficient. And then I imagine prices will come down as well too. But it's very exciting. It's also telling us too that many of these brain changes that we know are, say, linked with Alzheimer's disease, they start to occur many years before you might have obvious clinical symptoms. And that's interesting from a research point of view, which tells us that the pathology has to build up in the brain to reach some kind of threshold before you see a functional effect. It's also really super interesting for those people who are developing drugs, because there's really there's an idea that it's probably too late once somebody has had dementia for some years and it's developed substantially to give somebody a drug and hope that would stop or reverse the condition. So the focus of drug developers becoming to do it, to have a drug that you can use to intervene as early as possible. So now if we combine the blood test that says that you are at very high risk of developing dementia in the next 5 years, and then you then come in with a drug that helps to clear up the pathology, then you might have stopped dementia before it ever appears. So I think, again, the combination of new drugs and new biomarkers is hopefully going to move the field forward rather quickly.
You mentioned a potential challenge around implementation You give an example of the clinical settings as one example, right? How do you think about new technologies? AI is almost a bit of a buzzword, right? But I'm just wondering, University of Tasmania, experts from different disciplines, artificial intelligence being one of them, how do you think about working with colleagues in different fields to solve some of these implementation problems?
Yeah, no, I think, yeah, that's a good one. And so AI is coming rapidly, becoming a big part of medical research already. And in dementia, there have been some very interesting reports where people have used, for example, AI to analyze brain scans, again, to try and detect the very earliest changes in the brain before somebody might develop dementia or identify those at highest risk. And that's really interesting. At our work, which is through one of our colleagues, is a neurologist, Jane Olte, and she's been working very closely with computer scientists, and they're using AI with imaging, and they call it computer vision, and they get people to do tasks in front of a video, and it could be the video on your phone or the video in your laptop or whatever, but it's just simple tasks such as involving your hands, and what they're looking for is very subtle motor changes that might happen very early on in a pathway to neurodegeneration, either for dementia or something, Parkinson's disease. And what AI does, it helps to analyze those images in a way that human beings can't. So it can actually pull out lots of features to get to pick up these very subtle motor changes. For example, you're just asking people to open and shut their hands, touch their thumbs to their fingers and little tasks like that. The AI part of that can analyze that in quickly and in a way that gives you some results that you can then look at and analyze. So this is the basis of new tests that are being developed out of the University of Tasmania. But as you mentioned, it really did involve a whole bunch of disciplines coming together, particularly the computer sciences who work in a different part of the university to us, but also really good academics and clinicians who can make sense of that information. And in the middle, we've got some great people who have high skills in working with data and in statistics and so forth as well too, so they can make sense of what the AI analysis is producing as well too. Yeah, these sorts of projects are not things that usually just individuals can do. It does involve this collaboration. But the AI is, I like to say, is like coming like a freight train into medicine and clinical medicine. And it'll be really very useful at the end of the day in helping, particularly I think around the diagnosis and early diagnosis of a whole range of conditions.
Lots of causes for optimism.
Yes. But there's still a thing in there too. Like the research is really interesting. We've still got to make sure that it develops to the point that people can make use of that. And accessibility is something that does motivate us a bit, is how can we make some of this technology really efficient, really accessible, and therefore inexpensive, and can be used in a variety of different settings. So it shouldn't be that just people who are wealthy have access to these new technologies. It should be as widely available as possible. And that's why we're particularly keen on this test that we're developing, because a lot of people actually, they might have a smartphone or they might have access to a video camera. That's all you need. And then an internet connection, and that might help with data pathway of diagnosis as well too. So we've got to be really careful that we don't end up developing a whole bunch of things in research that might actually be useful, but only a small proportion of the world's population can ever access it.
For the research that's being conducted, at what point do you involve industry partners, feedback from the community to get a sense that these are real problems, yeah, where solutions will have actual benefits in society?
Yeah, no, that's a great point, because many of our projects or major projects, we often form a what we might call a consumer reference group. And these are key people who go from, they might have a technological insight through to people who have been affected by dementia or in some way as well too. And then we test various things with those groups as they develop. And that's been very important, for example, for testing this new diagnostic tool, which we call TAST, is that we that group is continually going out to smaller group of people who might well be end users to make sure that, you know, not only does it work technically, but is it accessible and does it make sense to the group that we want to take it up? And we also do that too a lot with our educational programs as well too, is that we think about who are the groups that are going to end up using whatever educational program we're developing, and then form up again these sort of reference groups that will help provide feedback along the way. And that does protract the development of those programs, but they do make them so much better because actually you can make them as relevant as possible, but also you can make much fewer mistakes that might appear in your end product as well too. And that's really easy enough to do. Either something doesn't work technically, or the language is wrong, or the pitch is wrong, or you know, it doesn't seem that relevant to the end user. So it's super valuable to us that people at the end of the day volunteer their time to be on those consumer reference groups. And they can often also offer really great suggestions around design as well too. So there are things that you have not thought of at all, and then the community reference group will straighten you out and put you back on the right direction as well too. So again, it's really become a very important part of the development process.
Yeah. There's no better truth serum than the market.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And that's one of the things too, even with the MOOCs, we do need to substantially review them through the next year or so. But over the years, we do get a lot of feedback from people who've done those courses, both what's useful and what's not so useful. And they have changed over time based on that feedback as well too. So we love getting feedback about what we do, even if sometimes it's not very comfortable, but at least if it's not working for somebody out there for a particular reason, there's a good chance it's not working for a lot of people for the same reason. So we do getting the feedback and I guess looking at where we can change things to make it better.
Thank you so much for this conversation, Professor. This has been really eye-opening for me. It's really interesting to understand the different dynamics when it comes to an institution working within dementia care. So I'm sure a lot of our listeners will get a ton of value from this.
Great. Thank you, Matthew. It's been lovely chatting to you.
How can people get in touch or reach out to University of Tasmania, learn a bit more of the courses?
Yeah, so probably the best way is to go to our website. And that's got information about all our courses and a bit about our research as well too. And it's got a contact path as well too. So just Google Wiking Dementia Center and it should come up right away.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Matthew.
Thanks for listening. If you want more of these type of stories, interviews and guests, please follow the Dementia Research Project wherever you get your podcasts. Onwards and upwards.